Chapter 4. The men's conversation had been carrying, with increasing clarity, through the flimsy dividing wall for a couple of minutes. Now, in the sudden silence following the cessation of the drill, Bristol's words were plainly audible. Purely for her own amusement, in the high spirits of this happy day, Robin had been trying to act convincingly the part of Strike's regular secretary, and not to give away to Bristol's girlfriend that she had actually only been working for the private detective for half an hour. She concealed as best she could any sign of surprise or excitement at the outbreak of shouting, but she was instinctively on Bristol's side, whatever the cause of the conflict. Strike's job and his black eye had a certain beaten-up glamour, but his attitude towards her was deplorable, and her left breast was still sore. Bristol's girlfriend had been staring at the closed door ever since the men's voices had first become audible over the noise of the drill. Thick-set and very dark, with a limp bob, and what might have been a monobrow if she had not plucked it, she looked naturally cross. Robin had often noticed how couples tended to be of roughly equivalent personal attractiveness, though of course factors such as money often seemed to secure a partner of significantly better looks than oneself. Robin found it endearing that Bristow, who on the evidence of his smart suit and his prestigious firm could have set his sights on somebody much prettier, had chosen this girl, who she assumed was warmer and kinder than her appearance suggested. "Are you sure you wouldn't like a coffee, Alison?" she asked. The girl looked around as though surprised at being spoken to, as though she had forgotten that Robin was there. "No, thanks," she said in a deep voice that was surprisingly melodious. "I knew he'd get upset," she added with an odd kind of satisfaction. "I've tried to talk him out of doing this, but he wouldn't listen. Sounds like this so-called detective is turning him down. Good for him." Robin's surprise must have shown, because Alison went on, with a trace of impatience. "It'd be better for John if he just accept the facts. She killed herself. The rest of the family have come to terms with it. I don't know why he can't." There was no point pretending that she did not know what the woman was talking about. Everyone knew what had happened to Lulu Landry. Robin could remember exactly where she had been when she had heard that the model had dived to her death on a sub-zero night in January, standing at the sink in the kitchen of her parents' house. The news had come over the radio, and she had emitted a little cry of surprise and run out of the kitchen in her nightshirt to tell Matthew, who was staying for the weekend. How could the death of someone you had never met affect you so? Robin had greatly admired Lulu Landry's looks. She did not much like her own milkmaid's colouring. The model had been dark, luminous, fine-boned and fierce. "It hasn't been very long since she died."
3 months, said Alison, shaking out her Daily Express. "Is he any good, this man?"
Robin had noticed Alison's contemptuous expression as she took in the dilapidated condition and undeniable grubbiness of the little waiting room, and she had just seen online the pristine, palatial office where the other woman worked. Her answer was therefore prompted by self-respect rather than any desire to protect Strike. "Oh yes," she replied coolly. "He's one of the best." She slit open a pink, kitten-embellished envelope with the air of a woman who daily dealt with the exigencies much more complex and intriguing than Alison could possibly imagine. Meanwhile, Strike and Bristow were facing each other across the inner room, the one furious, the other trying to find a way to reverse his position without jettisoning his self-respect. "All I want, Strike," said Bristow hoarsely, the colour high in his thin face, "is justice." He might have struck a divine tuning fork. The word rang through the shabby office, calling forth an inaudible but plangent note in Strike's breast. Bristow had located the pilot light Strike shielded when everything else had been blown to ashes. He stood in desperate need of money, but Bristow had given him another, better reason to jettison his scruples. "Okay, I understand. I mean it, John, I understand. Come back and sit down. If you still want my help, I'd like to give it." Bristow glared at him. There was no noise in the office but the distant shouts of the workmen below. "Would you like your, wife, is she, to come in?"
"No," said Bristow, still tense, with his hand on the doorknob. "Alison doesn't think I ought to be doing this. I don't know why she wanted to come along, actually. Probably hoping you'd turn me down."
"Please, sit down. Let's go over this properly." Bristow hesitated, then moved back towards his abandoned chair.
His self-restraint crumbling at last, Strike took a chocolate biscuit and crammed it whole into his mouth. He took an unused notepad from his desk drawer, flicked it open, reached for a pen, and managed to swallow the biscuit in the time it took for Bristow to resume his seat. "Shall I take that?" he suggested, pointing to the envelope Bristow was still clutching. The lawyer handed it over, as though unsure he could trust Strike with it. Strike, who did not wish to peruse the contents in front of Bristow, put it aside with a small pat, which was intended to show that it was now a valued component of the investigation, and readied his pen. "John, if you could give me a brief outline of what happened on the day your sister died, it would be very helpful." By nature methodical and thorough, Strike had been trained to investigate to a high and rigorous standard. First, allow the witness to tell their story in their own way. The untrammeled flow often revealed details, apparent inconsequentialities, that would later prove invaluable nuggets of evidence. Once the first gush of impression and recollection had been harvested, then it was time to solicit and arrange facts rigorously and precisely. People, places, property. "Oh," said Bristow, who seemed, after all his vehemence, unsure where to start. "I don't really... Let's see. When was the last time you saw her?" Strike prompted. "That would have been... Yes, the morning before she died. We had an argument, as a matter of fact, though thank God we made it up. What time is this?" "It was early, before 9. I was on my way into the office. Perhaps 8:45? "And what did you argue about?" "Oh, about her boyfriend, Evan Duffield. They just got back together again. The family had thought it was over, and we'd been so pleased. He's a horrible person, an addict, and a chronic self-publicist. About the worst influence on Lula you could imagine." "I might have been a bit heavy-handed. I see that now. I was 11 years older than Lula. I felt very protective of her, you know? Perhaps I was bossy at times. She was always telling me that I didn't understand." "Understand what?" "Well, anything. She had lots of issues. Issues with being adopted. Issues with being black in a white family. She used to say I had it easy. I don't know. Maybe she was right." He blinked rapidly behind his glasses. "The row was really the continuation of a row we'd had on the telephone the night before. I just couldn't believe she'd been so stupid as to get back to Duffield. The relief we all felt when they split up. I mean, given her own history of drugs, hooking up with an addict..." He drew breath. "She didn't want to hear it. She never did. She was furious with me. She'd actually given instructions to the security man at the flats not to let me pass the front desk next morning, but... Well, Wilson waved me through anyway." "Humiliating," thought Strike, "to have to rely on the pity of doormen." "I wouldn't have gone up," said Bristow miserably, blotches of colour dappling his thin neck again. "But I had the contract with some aide to give back to her. She'd asked me to look over it and she needed to sign it. She could be quite blasé about things like that. Anyway, she wasn't too happy that they'd let me upstairs and we were out again. But it burned itself out quite quickly. She calmed down. And then I told her that Mum would appreciate a visit. Mum had just got out of hospital, you see. She'd had a hysterectomy. Lila said she might pop in and see her later at her flat. But that she couldn't be sure. She had things on." Bristow took a deep breath. His right knee started jiggling up and down again, and his knuckled hands washed each other in dumb show. "I don't want you to think badly of her. People thought her selfish, but she'd been the youngest in the family and rather indulged. And then she was ill and naturally the centre of attention. And then she plunged into this extraordinary life where things, people revolved around her. And she was pursued everywhere by the paparazzi. It wasn't a normal existence." "No," said Strike. "So, anyway, I told Lila how groggy and sore Mum was feeling, and she said she might look in on her later. I left. I nipped into my office to get some files from Alison, because I wanted to work from Mum's flat that day and keep her company. I next saw Lila at Mum's, mid-morning. She sat with Mum for a while in the bedroom until my uncle arrived to visit, and then nipped into the study where I was working to say goodbye. She hugged me before she..." Bristow's voice cracked, and he stared down into his lap. "More coffee?" Strike suggested. Bristow shook his bowed head. To give him a moment to pull himself together, Strike picked up the tray and headed for the outer office. Bristow's girlfriend looked up from her newspaper, scowling, when Strike appeared. "Aren't you finished?" she asked.
"Evidently not," said Strike, with no attempt at a smile.
She glared at him while he addressed Robin.
"Could I get another cup of coffee?"
Robin stood up and took the tray from him in silence. "John needs to be back in the office at 10:30, Allison informed Strike, in a slightly louder voice. "We'll need to be off in 10 minutes at the most."
"I'll bear that in mind,"
Strike assured her blandly, before returning to the inner office, where Bristow was sitting as though in prayer, his head bowed over his clasped hands.
"I'm sorry," he muttered, as Strike sat back down. "Still difficult talking about it."
"No problem," said Strike, picking up his notebook again. "So Lula came to see your mother.
What time was that?"
11-ish.
"It all came out at the inquest, what she did after that. She got her driver to take her to some boutique that she liked, and then she went back to her flat. She had an appointment at home with a makeup artist she knew, and her friend Kira Porter joined her there. You'll have seen Kira Porter, she's a model. Very blonde. They were photographed together as angels, you probably saw it. Naked except for handbags and wings. So May used a picture in his advertising campaign after Lula died. People said it was tasteless. So Lula and Kira spent the afternoon together at Lula's flat, and then they left to go out to dinner, where they met up with Duffield and some other people. The whole group went on to Uzi, the nightclub, and they were there until past midnight. Then Duffield and Lula argued. Lots of people saw it happen. He manhandled her a bit, tried to make her stay, but she left the club alone. Everyone thought he'd done it afterwards, but he turned out to have a cast iron alibi.
Cleared on the evidence of his drug dealer, wasn't he? Asked Strike, still writing.
Yes, exactly. So Lula arrived back at her flat around 1:20. She was photographed going inside. You probably remember that picture. It was everywhere afterwards.
Strike remembered. One of the world's most photographed women, head bowed, shoulders hunched, eyes heavy and arms folded tightly around her torso, twisting her face away from the photographers. Once the verdict of suicide had been clearly established, it had taken on a macabre aspect. The rich and beautiful young woman, less than an hour from her death, attempting to conceal her wretchedness from the lenses she had courted, and which had so adored her.
Were there usually photographers outside her door?
Yes, especially if they knew she was with Duffield, or they wanted to get a shot of her coming home drunk. But they weren't only there for her that night. An American rapper was supposed to be arriving to stay in the same building that evening. D.B. Mack's his name. His record company had rented the apartment beneath hers. In the event he never stayed there, because with the police all over the building, it was easier for him to go to a hotel. But the photographers who had chased Lula's car when she left Uzi joined the ones who were waiting for Mack outside the flats, so that made quite a crowd of them around the entrance to the building, though they all drifted away not long after she'd gone inside. Somehow they got a tip off that Mack wouldn't be there for hours. It was a bitterly cold night, snowing, below freezing, so the street was empty when she fell. Bristow blinked and took another sip of cold coffee, and Strike thought about the paparazzi who had left before Lula Landry fell from her balcony. Imagine, he thought, what a shot of Landry diving to her death would have gone for. Enough to retire on, perhaps.
John, your girlfriend says you need to be somewhere at 10:30.
What?
Bristow seemed to return to himself. He checked the expensive watch and gasped.
Good God, I had no idea I'd been here so long. What happens now?
He asked, looking slightly bewildered.
You read my notes?
Yeah, of course, Strike assured him, and I'll call you in a couple of days when I've done some preliminary work. I expect you'll have a lot more questions then.
All right, said Bristow, getting dazedly to his feet.
Here, take my card.
And how would you like me to pay?
A month's fee in advance would be great, said Strike, quashing feeble stirrings of shame and remembering that Bristow himself had offered a double fee. He named an exorbitant amount, and to his delight, Bristow did not quibble, nor ask whether he accepted credit cards, nor even promised to drop the money in later, but drew out a real checkbook and a pen.
If, say, a quarter of it could be in cash, Strike added, chancing his luck, and was staggered for the second time that morning when Bristow said, I did wonder whether you'd prefer, and counted out a pile of 50s in addition to the check. They emerged out into the outer office at the very moment that Robin was about to enter with Strike's fresh coffee. Bristow's girlfriend stood up when the door opened and folded her newspaper with the air of one who'd been kept waiting too long. She was almost as tall as Bristow, large-framed, with a surly expression and big, mannish hands. "So you've agreed to do it, have you?" she asked Strike. He had the impression that she thought he was taking advantage of her rich boyfriend. Very possibly she was right. "Yes, Jones hired me," he replied. "Oh well," she said ungraciously. "You're pleased, I expect, John." The lawyer smiled at her, and she sighed and patted his arm, like a tolerant but slightly exasperated mother to a child. John Bristow raised his hand in salute, and then followed his girlfriend out of the room, and their footsteps clanged away down the metal stairs. Chapter 5. Strike turned to Robin, who had sat back down at the computer. His coffee was sitting beside the piles of neatly sorted mail lined up on the desk beside her. "Thanks," he said, taking a sip. "And for the note. Why are you a temp?" "What do you mean?" she asked, looking suspicious. "You can spell and punctuate. You catch on quick. You show initiative. Where did the cups and the tray come from? The coffee and biscuits." "I borrowed them all from Mr. Crowdy. I told him we'd return them by lunchtime."
"Mr. who?"
"Mr. Crowdy, the man downstairs. The graphic designer."
"And he just let you have them?"
"Yes," she said a little defensively. "I thought, having offered the client coffee, we ought to provide it." Her use of the plural pronoun was like a gentle pat to his morale. "Well, that was efficiency way beyond anything temporary solutions has sent here before. Take it from me. Sorry I kept calling you Sandra. She was the last girl."
"What's your real name?"
"Robin."
"Robin," he repeated. "That'll be easy to remember."
He had some notion of making a jocular allusion to Batman and his dependable sidekick, but the feeble jest died on his lips as her face turned brilliantly pink. Too late, he realised that the most unfortunate construction could be put onto his innocent words. Robin swung the swivel chair back towards the computer monitor so that all Strike could see was the edge of a flaming cheek. In one frozen moment of mutual mortification, the room seemed to have shrunk to the size of a telephone kiosk. "I'm going to nip out for a bit," said Strike, putting down his virtually untouched coffee and moving crabwise towards the door, taking down the overcoat hanging beside it. "If anyone calls..."
"Mr. Strike, before you go, I think you ought to see this."
Still flushed, Robin took from the top of the pile of the open letters beside her computer a sheet of bright pink writing paper and a matching envelope, both of which she had put into a clear plastic pocket. Strike noticed her engagement ring as she held the things up.
"It's a death threat," she said.
"Oh yeah," said Strike. "Nothing to worry about. They come in about once a week."
"But it's a disgruntled ex-client. Bit unhinged. He thinks he's throwing me off the scent by using that paper."
"Surely though, shouldn't the police see it?"
"Give them a laugh, you mean?"
"It isn't funny. It's a death threat," she said, and Strike realised why she had placed it with its envelope in the plastic pocket. He was mildly touched.
"Just file it with the others," he said, pointing towards the filing cabinets in the drawer. "If he was going to kill me, he'd have made his move before now. You'll find 6 months' worth of letters in there somewhere. Would you be all right to hold the fort for a bit while I'm out?"
"I'll cope," she said, and he was amused by the sour note in her voice and her obvious disappointment that nobody was going to fingerprint the begittened death threat. "If you need me, my mobile number is on the cards at the top drawer."
"Fine," she said, looking neither at the drawer nor him.
"If you want to go out for lunch, feel free. There's a spare key in the desk somewhere."
"Okay.
See you later then." He paused just outside the glass door, on the threshold of the tiny, dank bathroom. The pressure in his guts was becoming painful, but he felt that her efficiency and her impersonal concern for his safety entitled her to some consideration. Resolving to wait until he reached the pub, Strike headed downstairs. Out in the street, he lit a cigarette, turned left and proceeded past the closed 12-bar cafe, up the narrow walkway of Denmark Place, past a window full of multicoloured guitars and walls covered in fluttering flyers, away from the relentless pounding of the pneumatic drill. Skirting the rubble and wreckage of the street at the foot of Centre Point, he marched past a gigantic gold statue of Freddie Mercury, stood over the entrance of the Dominion Theatre across the road, head bowed, one fist raised in the air, like some pagan god of chaos. The ornate Victorian face of the Tottenham pub rose up behind the rubble and the roadworks, and Strike, pleasurably aware of the large amount of cash in his pocket, pushed his way through the doors into a serene Victorian atmosphere of gleaming, scrolled dark wood and brass fittings. Its frosted glass half-partitions, its aged leather banquettes, its bar mirrors covered in gilt cherubs and horns of plenty spoke of a confident and ordered world that was in satisfying contrast to the ruined street. Strike ordered a pint of Doombar and took it to the back of the almost deserted pub, where he placed his glass on the high circular table under the garish glass cupola in the ceiling, and headed straight to the gents, which smelled strongly of piss. 10 minutes later, and feeling considerably more comfortable, Strike was a third of the way into his pint, which was deepening the anaesthetic effect of his exhaustion. The Cornish beer tasted of home, peace, and long-gone security. It was a large and blurry painting of a Victorian maiden, dancing with roses in her hands, directly opposite him. Frolicking coyly as she gazed at him through a shower of petals, her enormous breasts, draped in white, she was as unlike a real woman as the table on which his pint rested, or the obese man with the ponytail who was working the pumps at the bar. And now Strike's thoughts swarmed back to Charlotte, who was indubitably real. Beautiful, dangerous as a cornered vixen, clever, sometimes funny, and in the words of Strike's very oldest friends, fucked to the core. Was it over? Really over this time? Cocooned in his tiredness, Strike recalled the scenes of last night and this morning. Finally, she had done something he could not forgive, and the pain would no doubt be excruciating once the anaesthetic wore off. But in the meantime, there were certain practicalities to be faced. It had been Charlotte's flat that they had been living in. Her stylish, expensive maisonette in Holland Park Avenue, which meant that he was, as of 2 o'clock that morning, voluntarily homeless. Bluey, just move in with me, for God's sake. You know it makes sense. You can save money while you're building up the business, and I can look after you. You shouldn't be on your own while you're recuperating, Bluey. Don't be silly. Nobody would ever call him Bluey again. Bluey was dead. It was the first time in their long and turbulent relationship that he had walked out. 3 times previously, it had been Charlotte who had called a halt. There had been an unspoken awareness between them, always, that if ever he left, if ever he decided he had had enough, the parting would be of an entirely different order to all those she had instigated, none of which, painful and messy as though they had been, had ever felt definitive. Charlotte would not rest until she had hurt him as badly as she could in retaliation. This morning's scene, when she had tracked him to his office, had doubtless been a mere foretaste of what would unfold in the months, even years, to come. He had never known anyone with such an appetite for revenge. Strike limped to the bar, secured a second pint, and returned to the table for further gloomy reflection. Walking out in Charlotte had left him on the brink of true destitution. He was so deeply in debt that all that stood between him and the sleeping bag in the doorway was John Bristow. Indeed, if Gillespie called in the loan that had formed the down payment on Strike's office, Strike would have no alternative but to sleep rough. "I'm just calling to check in how things are going, Mr. Strike, because this month's installment still hasn't arrived. Can we expect it within the next few days?" And finally, since he had started looking at the inadequacies of his life, why not make a comprehensive survey? There was his recent weight gain, a full stone and a half, so that he not only felt fat and unfit, but was putting unnecessary additional strain on the prosthetic lower leg he was now resting on the brass bar beneath the table. Strike was developing the shadow of a limp purely because the additional load was causing some chafing. The long walk across London in small hours, kit bag over his shoulder, had not helped. Knowing that he was heading to penury, he had been determined to travel there in the cheapest fashion. He returned to the bar to buy a third pint. Back at his table beneath the cupola, he drew out his mobile phone and called a friend of the Metropolitan Police, whose friendship, though of only a few years' duration, had been forged under exceptional conditions. Just as Charlotte was the only person to call him Bluey, so Detective Inspector Richard Anstis was the only person to call Strike Mystic Bob, which name he bellowed at the sound of his friend's voice. "Looking for a favour," Strike told Anstis. "Name it." "Who handled the Lilander case?"
While Anstis searched out their numbers, he asked for Strike's business, right leg and fiancé. Strike lied about the status of all three.
Glad to hear it, said Anstis cheerfully. Okay, here's Wardle's number. He's all right. Loves himself, but you'll be better off with him than Carver. He's a cunt.
I can put in a word with Wardle.
I'll ring him right now for you if you like.
Strike tweaked a tourist leaflet from the wooden display in the wall and copied down Wardle's number in the space beside a picture of the horse guards.
When are you coming over? Anstis asked.
Bring Charlotte one night.
Yeah, that'll be great. I'll give you a ring. Got a lot on just now.
After hanging up, Strike sat in deep thought for a while, then called an acquaintance much older than Anstis, whose life path had run in a roughly opposite direction.
Calling in a favour, mate, said Strike. Need some information.
On what?
You tell me. I need something I can use for leverage with a copper.
The conversation ran to 25 minutes and involved many pauses, which grew longer and more pregnant until finally Strike had given an approximate address and two names, which he also copied down beside the horse guards, and a warning, which he did not write down, but took in the spirit in which he knew it was intended. The conversation ended on a friendly note, and Strike, now yawning widely, dialed Wardle's number, which was answered almost immediately by a loud, curt voice.
Wardle?
Yeah, hello. My name's Cormoran Strike, and...
You're what?
Cormoran Strike, said Strike, is my name.
Oh, yeah, said Wardle. Anstis just rang.
You're the private dick.
Anstis said you were interested in talking about Little Landry.
Yeah, I am, said Strike again, suppressing another yawn as he examined the painted panels in the ceiling. Bacchanalian revels that became, as he looked, a feast of fairies. Midsummer Night's Dream. A man with a donkey's head.
But what I really like is the file.
Wardle laughed.
You didn't save my fucking life, mate.
Got some information you might be interested in. Thought we could do an exchange. There was a short pause.
I take it you don't want to do this exchange over the phone.
That's right, said Strike. Is there anywhere you'd like to have a pint after a hard day's work? Having jotted down the name of a pub near Scotland Yard and agreed that a week today, failing any nearer date, would suit him too, Strike rang off. It had not always been thus. A couple of years ago he had been able to command the compliance of witnesses and suspects. He had been like Wardle, a man whose time had more value than most of those with whom he consorted, and who could choose when, where, and how long interviews would be. Like Wardle, he needed no uniform. He had been constantly cloaked in officialdom and prestige. Now he was a limping man in a creased shirt, trading in old acquaintances, trying to do deals with policemen who would once have been glad to take his calls.
"Arsehole," said Strike aloud into his echoing glass.
The third pint had slid down so easily that there was barely an inch left. His mobile rang. Glancing at the screen, he saw his office number. No doubt Robin was trying to tell him that Peter Gillespie was after money. He let her go straight to voicemail, drained his glass and left. The street was bright and cold, the pavement damp, and the puddles intermittently silver as clouds scudded across the sun. Strike lit another cigarette outside the front door and stood smoking in the doorway to Tottenham, watching the workmen as they moved around the pit and the road. Cigarette finished, he ambled off down Oxford Street to kill time until the temporary solution had left and he could sleep in peace.